Hello, and welcome to Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. It's July 17th, 2016. It was on this day in 1996, 20 years ago, that TWA Flight 800, headed from New York to Paris, exploded off the coast of Long Island, killing all 230 people on board. Now, here's what's ahead on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto takes us to one of the most diverse universities in the United States. It has students from more than 130 nations. Pete's report is part of our series about international student life at colleges and universities across the United States. Then, Anna Mateo will be with us, as she is every Sunday, with Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Anna brings us the first part of her two-part report on the many American English expressions using the word apple. And as we always do on the Sunday edition of Learning English Weekend, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week, we report on the presidential election of 1928. It was an election in which voters had a clear political choice. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. Every day of the year, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And every Sunday, we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America. Now, as we do every Sunday, we tell you what is happening in American higher education. Today's report is part of our new series about international education students who are studying at colleges and universities across the United States. This week, correspondent Pete Musto tells us about a large university near Washington, D.C., that has students from many countries.
Diversity has been a major concern at U.S. universities in recent years. Most schools try to attract a wide mix of students. They want students from different racial, religious, geographical, and economic backgrounds. Konstantinos Papagiorgiou is from Greece. Nick Osman is from Malaysia. And Soline Reyes is from Venezuela. The one thing all three students have in common is that they all study at George Mason University. The large university is one of the most diverse in the United States. It attracts students from 130 countries. George Mason University, or Mason for short, is located in Fairfax, Virginia, less than an hour outside of Washington, D.C. Mason was once part of the University of Virginia, but the schools separated in 1957. And now Mason is the largest public research university in Virginia. In addition to the Fairfax campus, there are three other Mason campuses in Virginia and one in Songdo, South Korea. Papa Giorgio, Osman, and Reyes all enjoyed the international feel of Washington, D.C., the U.S. capital city. So they wanted to stay close when they started looking for schools where they could earn their undergraduate degrees. Reyes first came to Washington, D.C. to improve her English abilities. She heard of Mason from her uncle, who had studied there in the past. Reyes was pleased with Mason's international feel when she started studying there in 2014.
When I first arrived, I was hanging out with a bunch of Saudi people, and they became like really nice friends of mine, and also they start teaching me how to speak in Arabic. Also, now I have a best friend that is from Mexico. Even though we have the same language, we have different dialects. So it's like I learned something from her and she learned from me.
Papa Giorgio's father worked in the Greek Navy, and his family moved to the Washington, D.C. area when Papa Giorgio was in high school. He began studying economics at Mason in 2011. He says he had trouble at first understanding some of the more complex parts of the English language. But sharing these difficulties with other international students helped him.
It was hard for me to understand the native speakers, if they were being polite or if they're being sarcastic. I couldn't tell the difference. I was always questioning them. But there were other kids in my situation, so I had no issue adjusting.
Papa Giorgio lived in housing provided by the university called dormitories, or dorms, for his first 2 years at Mason. Students live together in these large buildings at almost every university across the U.S. At George Mason University, most first-year students are required to live in the dorms. Papa Giorgio says living in the dorms was a very fun experience. He met and made friends with American and international students. He also says that he and his friends had some crazy parties. One time, one of his friends even cut off both of his eyebrows. Azmin joined her mother in the Washington, D.C. area when her mother came to work at the Malaysian embassy. She says before she came to study public relations at Mason in 2012, she was afraid.
When I knew that I was coming here, I was really shocked because of everything that the movies told me, these perceptions about university as party life, and I wasn't about that. But what you see in the movies is not what you see in real life.
Azmin says some students focus more on their studies and others focus more on social activities. It may take time, she adds, but students can find their place at Mason if they try. Now Azmin works with the International Student Advisory Board, a group of students and staff members who help international students find the resources they need. She also works as an orientation leader for new international students. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Every Sunday over the next several weeks, Pete will continue to bring you stories about international students and their experiences at American colleges and universities. Now, if it's Sunday, it's time for Ana Mateo and Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Ana brings us the first part of her two-part report on the word apple, which is at the core of many American English expressions.
The saying, as American as apple pie, describes things that represent the best of American culture. People use this expression when talking about things like blue jeans, baseball, and rock and roll music. But why use apple pie? Why not some other fruit, like a cherry or peach? The reason might be a man known as Johnny Appleseed. A lot of stories and even a few poems have been written about Johnny Appleseed over the years. They made him into a larger-than-life folk hero. Yet Johnny Appleseed was a real person. It was the name given to a man named John Chapman. Many Americans consider him responsible for popularizing apples in the United States. John Chapman was born in Massachusetts in 1774 during the Revolutionary War against Britain. His father reportedly fought at the Battle of Bunker Hill and later served under General George Washington. While John's mother died in childbirth, his father made it home from battle. He taught his son everything he knew about farming. The young Chapman took his father's lessons to heart. For 40 years, Johnny Appleseed is said to have cleared land and planted apple seeds in the Midwestern states of the U.S. In a short time, the seeds grew to become trees that produced fruit. Apples were an important food for the early American settlers. Apples offered something different in daily meals. They were easy to grow and store for use throughout the year. Perhaps the story of Johnny Appleseed has made apples and apple pie so very American. Historians can debate that, but this we do know. Apples are at the core, get it? Core is the center of the apple, of many common sayings. Many apples fall from trees when they are fully grown. When we say that an apple didn't fall far from the tree, we are describing children who are very much like their mother or father. And this can be for both good and bad reasons. As we said, John Chapman's father was a farmer. So we could say that Johnny Appleseed's apple really didn't fall far from the tree. That takes this expression to a whole new level. Naturally, apple growers need a way to transport their produce to market. This is where a vehicle called an apple cart enters the story. It must have been a big mistake years ago to upset or overturn someone's apple cart. In American English, you have upset the apple cart if you ruin someone's plans or go against the usual way of doing things. In fact, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines an apple cart as a plan, system, or situation that may be disrupted or ended. But the verb used with the apple cart expression is usually upset. The first recorded use of apple cart being used in this way appeared in 1788. A man named Jeremy Belknap wrote in the History of New Hampshire that Adams had almost overset the apple cart by intruding an amendment of his own fabrication on the morning of the day of ratification. This is yet another example of how apples seem very American. I'm Ana Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Next week, Anna will explain the phrases, "An apple a day keeps the doctor away," "A good apple," "One bad apple spoils the whole barrel," "Rotten to the core," and a few others. Now, as we do every Sunday, we present The Making of a Nation. The presidential election of 1928 gave American voters a clear political choice. The Democratic Party nominated Al Smith. He was the popular governor of the state of New York. The Republican Party chose Herbert Hoover. He was an engineer and businessman who had served as Secretary of Commerce for Presidents Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge. This week in our series, Rich Kleinfeld and Harry Monroe tell us about the contest between Smith and Hoover.
Governor Alfred Smith of New York had campaigned for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1924. But he was defeated at the party convention by a compromise candidate, John Davis. 4 years later, however, Smith could not be stopped. He had a strong record as governor of the nation's most heavily populated state. He campaigned for the presidency on a policy of building new electric power stations under public control. Smith knew that many conservative Americans might be worried by his new ideas and his belief in strong government. So he chose as his campaign manager a Republican industrial leader who had worked with General Motors, DuPont, and other major companies. Smith hoped this would prove his faith in the American private business system.
Al Smith was a strong political leader and an effective governor, but he frightened many Americans, especially conservative citizens living in rural areas. They lived on farms or in small towns. Al Smith was from the city, and not just from any city, but New York City, a place that seemed big and dirty and filled with foreign people and strange traditions. Al Smith's parents came from Ireland. He grew up in New York and worked as a salesman at the Fulton Fish Market. Smith was an honest man, but many rural Americans simply did not trust people from big cities. Al Smith seemed to them to represent everything that was new, different, and dangerous about American life. But being from New York City was not Al Smith's only problem. He also opposed the new national laws that made it illegal to buy or produce alcoholic drinks. And he had political ties to the New York political machine. But worst of all, in the eyes of many Americans, Al Smith was a Roman Catholic.
From George Washington through Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and up to Calvin Coolidge, every American president had been male, white, and a Protestant Christian. Of course, there was no law requiring a candidate to be Protestant, but millions of traditional Americans just were not ready to give their vote to a Roman Catholic. Opponents of the Smith campaign generally did not speak openly about his religion, but many of them were afraid that Smith would take his orders from the Vatican in Rome instead of working with the Congress in Washington. Al Smith fought back. He told the country, "I am unable to understand how anything I was taught to believe as a Catholic could possibly be in conflict with what is good citizenship. My faith, he said, is built upon the laws of God. There can be no conflict between them.
But many Protestant Americans thought there was a conflict, and they looked to the Republican Party to supply a strong candidate to oppose Smith and the Democrats. The Republicans did just that. They nominated former Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover, one of the country's most popular men. Hoover was well known to Americans. People trusted him, and they liked the way he had gained great personal success from poor beginnings. In fact, Hoover's life story would have pleased Abraham Lincoln, another American who rose from a poor family to fame. Hoover was born in the farm state of Iowa in 1874. His father was a poor metal worker who kept moving his family from state to state. Herbert Hoover's father died when the boy was just 6 years old. His mother died 4 years later. Young Herbert had to move to the western state of Oregon to live with his mother's brother. Herbert's uncle was luckier in life than Herbert's parents. He had made money in the land business, and he helped the boy gain admission to Stanford University in California. At the university, Herbert showed great skill in mathematics, and he decided to go into business as a geologist, studying the science of the earth.
After college, Herbert Hoover got a job as a mine worker. During the next several years, Hoover spent most of his time working as an engineer in foreign countries. And he succeeded beyond his greatest dreams. By the time he was 40 years old, he had earned more than $1 million. After World War I, he organized the effort to provide food for starving people in Europe. He did an excellent job, winning praise from people in Europe and the United States alike. Next, Hoover joined the administration of President Warren Harding, serving as the Secretary of Commerce. Again, he did a very good job. Hoover left the cabinet in 1925. But 2 years later, he organized efforts to provide relief for victims of a flood in the southern state of Mississippi. And again, Americans all around the country took note of this quiet, serious man who did such effective work in so many different kinds of situations. Some Americans, however, did not like Hoover, including some people who usually supported Republicans. For example, many professional Republican politicians did not trust him because he had spent most of his life in business, not politics. Some stock market traders thought Hoover might change the rules on the New York Stock Exchange. And many farmers believed Hoover had no new ideas about how to solve their growing economic problems.
This, then, was the choice Americans faced in 1928. On the one hand, Al Smith, a Democrat, a Roman Catholic, a politician from the city, a man wanting some social change. And on the other hand, Herbert Hoover, a Republican, a businessman who had proven the dream that even a poor boy could become great in America, a man who seemed to succeed with every effort he touched. The main issue in the campaign was not economics or religion, but the new national laws banning alcoholic drinks. Hoover was for the laws, Smith against them. The two candidates also argued about how to provide aid to struggling farmers and how to increase electricity and water supplies.
Herbert Hoover won the election of 1928. It was one of the greatest victories in presidential history. Hoover won 58% of the votes. Smith got just 40%. And Hoover captured 444 electoral votes to Smith's 87. And so it was that the engineer and businessman, Herbert Hoover, entered the White House in 1929. There was some trouble the day he moved in. Outgoing President Coolidge was a man who watched every dollar he owned. And he accused some White House workers of stealing his shoes on the day of the inauguration. But finally, safe, conservative, businesslike Herbert Hoover was leading the country.
The nation's stock market reacted by pushing stock prices to record high levels. Everyone expected that economic growth would continue and expand. But the happy times were just a dream. Within 1 year, the stock market collapsed. Millions of people lost their jobs. The nation fell into the worst economic crisis it had ever faced. The Great Depression had arrived. Herbert Hoover was not personally responsible for the crisis. In many ways, it was just bad luck to be elected right before the disaster struck. But it was his job to guide the nation through its troubled waters, and he would prove to be the wrong person to give such leadership. His 4 years in office would be one of the most difficult periods in the nation's history. We will look at Herbert Hoover's presidency next week on The Making of a Nation on Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online at learningenglish.voanews.com. While you are visiting our website, you can also read and listen to longer versions of the stories that you have just heard on this program. Next week on the program, in addition to The Making of a Nation, we will tell you what is happening in higher education. And Anna Mateo will be here, as always, with Words and Their Stories. That's all next Sunday, so don't miss it. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. Jonathan Evans will be here tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with As It Is Monday, the weekday Learning English broadcast, webcast, and podcast from the Voice of America.